Hi, welcome to today's episode of The Social Connection, and I've got a exciting guest known as Joe Levy. Joe, thank you very much for accepting my invitation to come onto this podcast.
Pleasure. Happy to be here.
Brilliant. I want you to inform our listeners of what you're all about, where are you now? But before we go into that, I wanted to give you five quick-fire questions. And I mean quick, because no one's using sticking to that trend. So my first question is, cats or dogs?
Oh, dogs.
What is your least favourite house chore?
House chore, well, family chore, changing nappies. House chore, making beds.
All right. Right move or Zoopla?
Right move.
Favourite food?
Thai.
And your least favourite sport?
Least favourite sport, golf.
Ah, okay, cool. I thought you might say ramen for your favourite food when we had a chat last time.
favourite food is ramen, but ramen's a bit like a Christmas dinner. You can't have it every single day. So, you know, my favourite meal in the world is a Christmas dinner, but I can't say that because I have it once a year. you know, so Thai seems to be the flavour of the month, shall we say, at the moment, because it's pretty healthy, it's pretty quick, it's pretty inexpensive. So, it's, you know, everyone can do it and it's delicious. So, my taste buds can change, but for this month, Thai flavour of the month.
Brilliant. Right. So, you're the managing director of Bradgate Estates, and if you're from Leicestershire, East Midlands, you know, they've heard about Joe Levy or Bradgate Estates. But if you can give us a quick kind of introduction to yourself and what you're all about, please.
Yeah, no worries. So, my name's Joe Levy. I'm the managing director of a company called Bradgate Estates. I've also got a couple of other companies as well that I'm managing director of. But this is the biggest company that I'm most well known for. We're developers, we're investors, and we're landlords. And what that means is that we invest in other people's businesses, and I do that privately as well. And we partner with other businesses as well. So that's the investment side. We're developers because we develop high-end student and PRS, private rented sector blocks, ranging from 14 high-end units up to 570, £30 million GDV deals. The last deals that we've done was a 137-bed unit on London Road next to the train station, through our Abode brand, and that's fully let and managed by our operating company, Abode Lettings. And the second deal that we did was a 31 million GDV scheme in Sheffield called Brooks Place, which we sold to Grainger PLC, the largest landlord in the country. And we're currently on the final throng of 117 units in the Lace Market, in Nottingham's historic Lace Market, which is a bit like the Covent Garden of Nottingham. And that's forward funded by Edmund de Rothschilds.
Oh, brilliant. It sounds like you've got a lot of fingers in pies, but how do you pretty much delegate your work? Is your team solely focused? Do you have teams so that you've got the investment side, you've got the development side, then you've got the exit strategy type of thing? How does your team work then?
Yeah, great question. So it's all about scaling up, I think, as you'll know. You start off small, and then as you get bigger, you need to scale up. The way we work is on a ring-fenced, what's the best way to put it? Each deal's ring-fenced in terms of the team that we use. And what we've found is that actually the bigger the deal, the more zeros at the end of it, the more slick the operation is because of the level and caliber of the professionals you're working with. So actually, it's usually the smaller the deals that you do, the more complicated they are. So for instance, on the Sheffield deal, our team consists of project managers, architects, lawyers, accountants, and then each director, and we've got three directors, will be in charge of each project. And that's liaising from the project manager. We always designate a third-party project manager for each, shall I say, big deal, which are £20 million plus. Usually they're probably £5 million plus, even £1 million plus. The bank will insist on having a project managing company. And that actually does us both justice. That's a third party company, usually a quantity surveying firm. They'll overlook the scheme and not so much project manage it, but they'll guide the process and report back to you. So each project has its own team headed up by a director that reports back to the managing director, myself.
So you're spending the money on the relevant people, the best people in the job to save you time, money. Whereas if you're just starting up in the property development side of things, money is the main kind of dominance of decision making, and you tend to normally take the shortcut, and then in the long run, it never pays off, or something's always longer. So you're pretty much saying if the bigger, the better, but the bigger, the easier if you've got the right people.
The bigger, the easier once your team's in place, because the team, that you know, to rise to the top of deals, £30 million plus, you've got to be of top caliber. So it's a pleasure working with these people. And once you've done one deal with them, as I said, it's all about the team. And once the team's successful, whether that's the same business partner, same lawyer, same transactional lawyers, the accountants, the tax advisors, once you work together as a team on one project, just like any team, you get to spend time with each other and you know how the others work, and you become, you know, a single organism, should you say, working towards the same goal. So when you move on to the next deal, you've already got that team. So we'll have three different teams on three different schemes. Some of them intermingle. So we might have the same architect on two of the scheme, or we might have the same project manager on two of the schemes. But we do like to put our eggs in separate baskets just in case any of the team members fall through, get poached, move away, God forbid anything happens to them, so we can replace them. But generally, each deal's ring-fenced with a team. And, you know, going back to your point of spending the money up front, pays back later, yes, it does. Otherwise, my time will be completely bogged down with every single detail of every single deal, whereas it frees me up to go and look for the pipeline projects, sharpen our pencils in terms of payments that we're paying long-term to the bank, make improvements and efficiencies. But I also have debriefings on every single project each day with the main problems that come up so we can solve them.
Brilliant. Now, let's roll it back a bit. I know you've graduated from Nottingham Trent University within the property sector. So was that your decision? Or, I mean, when you were a kid, nobody wants to be a property developer, right?
I wanted to be a businessman. I used to, everyone I think looks up to their fathers, or they've got a fatherly figure or an adult role model. Mine was definitely my dad. But he was one of those chaps that I didn't see in the morning because he was gone, and I rarely saw him because I was in bed by the time he got back, but he was always there at the weekend. But I just love the fact that he worked for himself. He made his own decisions. He wore a nice suit, went into work, and he was the boss. So I thought, right, I want to be the boss. I want to have my own company one day. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know what I wanted to do until I was 24, even after I did my degree. So what happened was I was at school, and my dad has high expectations, although he's a very busy man, and he never went to any of my parents' evenings. He went to my first parents' evening when I was halfway through my first year of AS levels, and I was getting Bs instead of As, and they said I was capable of getting As. He immediately took me out of the school and said, "You're not going to school anymore. You failed me. You should be getting As, and you're getting Bs. Not good enough. You're now going to work for my property." At the time it was clothes manufacturing, my clothes manufacturing industry, which I knew nothing about. All I knew is my father used to embarrass me because he'd walk past mannequins and he'd be sniffing the leggings and stretching them because he's not seen this type of material. It's nylon viscous lycra, he'd say. "This is amazing." I'm like, "Dad, put the leggings down. You know, we're in next. No one else understands what you're doing." But I never understood the clothes manufacturing, the garment industry. It didn't appeal to me in any way. So my father put me out of school and put me straight on the factory floor. And I even said to him, "Look, Dad, you know, I'm pretty good at maths. I should really be in the office, you know, in the accounts department." He says, "Nobody runs my empire without starting at the bottom." So I literally started at the bottom. I was sweeping floors, loading vans. And I did that for a while. And then I realized to myself that not your mentors don't always know best. Don't get me wrong. Always take, you know, the advice that they give, but remember that it is advice. And some of the best decisions I've ever made have been in defiance of my father's wishes, because everyone has their own agenda. You've got to remember that in business as well. And my father's agenda, which was fair enough, I was his oldest son. He wanted me to run his clothes manufacturing business. I wasn't interested. I see his point starting at the bottom. I saw my friends, though, that were doing their AS levels and going to uni. So I turned around and said, no, I'm going to go to uni. He said, well, you're not. I'm not paying for it. So I used the fact that my mother and father had split up. My mum was a single mum. And I presented it forward on that basis to get a grant. So I actually went to London and did, against my father's wishes, and did my AS and A2 levels in 1 year. Achieved my AS and A2 levels. I then went to university in Nottingham Trent to do property and planning and property development degree. And my father was very interested in that and said, fair enough, you got in, but I'm not paying any money for you. So I had to get out the full student loans. And as I progressed and did better and better in my course, I actually had a phone call from one of my lecturers and said, listen, can you tell your dad to stop ringing up and asking how you're doing? This isn't school and it doesn't work like that. So I turned around to my dad and I basically said, look, none of my siblings have got any student loans. Okay, I understand the fact that they're doing very well at uni and you're financing it. But if you don't finance me after you found out I'm succeeding academically, I will never forgive you. So from that moment on, he funded me, but I didn't cancel my student loans. I just went traveling around the world when I finished. And that was my carrot for working hard. I thought, I am going to study. And my course was hard. And excuse the phrase, Mickey Mouse courses, which some of my friends were doing. I'm not going to name what they are and downgrade them. But they seem to just, you know, go out every single day, spend an hour a week doing assignments, and making a movie at the end of it and getting an A, whereas mine was, you know, serious hard work. So my carrot was traveling around the world when I finished, which I did.
But were you the type of person that would get your head down and do the actual work when you were at university?
Oh, 100%. I think one of the most important things is that, you know, I went to university because I thought I could pass it and finish it and it would benefit my future career. I also wanted to avoid work for the next 3 years, to be honest with you, because I wasn't quite ready for the world yet. But when I start something, I finish it, unless something absolutely extreme stops me. So it was absolutely vital that I finished it. And every year that I passed in uni made it even more it made me even more determined to finish, because those 2 years of my life could have been wasted with all that debt unless I passed the final year. So no, it was extremely important for me to finish and finish with the best mark that I could possibly get. It doesn't matter whether I got a C, whether I got a B, whether I got a first. Sorry, you know, as long as I did my best, that was all that I could ask myself for.
So coming from university, you must have had a career break or, you know, for a couple of years and thought, you know what, I still don't know what I'm doing.
Exactly. That brings us back to the point that you were making, you know, about and I was making about what I wanted to do. And it's OK not to know what you want to do. The most important thing and having a degree isn't all important. Let's get that out there now. It was quite important to my path, because when you go into the professional world of construction and borrowing millions of pounds from a bank without a long track record of success, that academic accreditation does help you. It is a box that's on their form that needs ticking that shows that you do have academic qualifications as well as experience. But apprenticeships, getting into work early, starting from the bottom, it's just, if not sometimes, a faster way to getting to the top of whatever profession you want to get into. But there are certain ones where this does help. And, you know, construction and surveying degree does have academic qualifications. What was your question? I've forgotten it. Sorry.
Don't worry. So my whole take was there's a lot of people that actually graduate or even going through their A-levels. Yeah. They've done it, but they've not got the next indication of where to go. Now, when people come onto this, I think 80% of the people I speak to, they're like, okay, I've got this graduate program. I'm going to see how it goes. And most likely they'll stay there for 5 years because they're doing a good job. But the right turn for that is, shit, what am I going to do? I don't know where to go. I've been applying for these jobs. And the whole of the world on social media is about entrepreneurship, being a businessman. But they might not really have the kind of the drive to do it. So what did you do to kind of have that gap and then the transition to, you know, where you are?
Yeah. So for me, when I got my degree, or if anybody gets an academic qualification, it's banked forever. You know, it's there, it's done. I can be skint. I can go to anywhere in the world, but I can get a job because I've got a degree, or you've, you know, relating it to other people that don't go to university to make sure they don't feel left out. You've got your apprenticeship, you know, you've passed a qualification, you've got your chippy qualifications or the builders, whatever it is, it's banked, it's there, and it's there forever. So that's the first most important step, and it is a step. You've got a mountain to climb. That's the way I looked at it in reality. You're standing at the bottom of a mountain. You know at the top of the mountain is where you want to be, when you can be the CEO of a company. You can make big decisions. You can, you know, go out for lunch. I wanted my bank manager to invite me out for lunch. I wanted to say, oh, I can't, I'm going out with my lawyer. This is what my father has said. I'm like, wow, yeah. I'm going to Subway. You know, that's what I'm going for lunch. You're going out for lunch with your bank manager to Casa Romano. That was where I wanted to be. That was the top of the mountain in my view. But the first step was to bank your degree. That is the equivalent of base camp. Okay. Then don't be afraid that you don't know what to do after, because you're never going to leave base camp. You can go for a ride, you can go for a drive, you can go for a fly around the world, but you will come back to base camp, not back to the bottom of the mountain. So that's what I thought to myself. I've worked damn hard for 3 years, and I'm having a gap year, and I'm traveling around the world. And as mentioned, I'd saved up my student loans, and I used that as my carrot, and I traveled around the world, and I had a fantastic time. I learned a lot. I learned a lot about tolerances of other people's cultures, patience as well. Keeps your feet on the ground. It teaches you how to act with a various number of people as well, and get a perspective of different worlds.
Different characteristics is such a good trait to have, isn't it? Knowing what's in store. Yeah.
And it also gives you confidence as well, you know, to go on a bus through Rio de Janeiro, you know, when you're 21 years old, or to Colombia, you know, and places like that. It really does make you aware of your surroundings. It makes you more streetwise. And when you come back, I came back a better, more rounded, more tolerant, cultured being, in a sense. And I also got my youth out of my system. You know, I'm now ready for work, but I still didn't really know what I was going to do. I knew I wanted to get into the property business, but I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. So that's when I got back, and my father turned around and said, right, until you get a job, you're going to go and work for me as my apprentice. Now, I was happy to do that, because at this point, he'd actually, in those 3 years that I went to university, although he was in the clothes manufacturing industry, he was smart enough to understand that he owned his own buildings. So when it all moved to the Far East, he was left with a number of major commercial units in the city and quite a number of dye factories on the canals. So he'd made that transition just by not so much luck, by bad luck. And this is one of his famous sayings, which I hold by: if you can turn a disadvantage into an advantage, then you'll conquer the world. You know, so if a big disadvantage happens to you in your business, as far as my father was concerned, his entire business was falling through overnight, along with thousands of other clothes manufacturers, when it all went abroad. Orders coming in, no income coming in. What do you do? Well, he made a massive advantage out of a disadvantage, because he used the buildings that he operated in to actually turn into flats, which was far more valuable. And being related to the clothing industry, they were all the dye factories were on the canals, which is now the highest spec demand, you know, for penthouse apartments, etc. Yeah. And all the other units were old brownfield sites, which could no longer trade as clothes manufacturing because it's gone abroad, but the council were eager to see it rejuvenated, therefore giving planning permission for a large number of flats. So it was a perfect match of minds. I've finished my degree, he's become a property developer, why don't you become my protege? I can teach him the academic side of things and how to do appraisals, i.e. how to value land properly. I also brought a more corporate element to the business. You know, my dad started off as a market trader. That was what his spirit was like, and that's what he's like. But when you come to doing big deals, you need to be corporately trained, and you need to be able to have a bit more depth of management, whereas my dad was a one-man show. So I was my dad's apprentice. But that was very difficult working for my father. I remember my dad was sat on his computer at home, and that was his office at the time. You know, he was lucky enough to work where he wanted to work. We don't need big posh fancy offices at Bradgate Estates. We're a bit like locusts. We go from building to building that we're developing. So we'll stay in a building for 2 years, get planning, then we'll move on to the pipeline project, whether that's an old hairdresser's, whether it's, you know, a 20,000 foot industrial space. That's where we'll go to save overheads and costs. So my dad was working from his home office. I was sat behind him, and then he'd just sort of turn around and go, "Oh yeah, I forgot you were there. Take this to the dry cleaners. Go and pick my son up at 4 o'clock." You know, or when he had a business meeting, he'd turn around and make me go and get more pims, you know, and stuff like that. So I learned a lot off him, but I also was being a bit restricted in terms of what my abilities were. And I kept putting deals forward to him to try and show him, you know, look, I've scoured the internet, I've gone through the auction books, I've found this property, I've done an appraisal, and we can earn 250 grand turning it into flats. And he just looked at me and said, "Joe, this isn't big enough for what we do. And, you know, forget about it." And I'm like, "Well, 250,000 quid for 2 years' work might not be big enough for you and the company, but for me, this is huge. This is a major opportunity, and I want you to back me." And he turned around and said, "I'm not backing you. You need to concentrate." And then he said, "Oh, when I die, you will get it anyway." And I went, "All right, well, what am I supposed to do? Just sit back and hope?" I said, "Dad, that's awful. You know, I need to carve out my own career."
Did you think that there's something to prove to him at that point? Because there's no, there's nothing.
Yes,
why would he give someone?
I mean, he
must be thinking, "Well, I'm telling you what to do. You've got no experience in what I do. So how am I going to listen to you?"
Not really. I mean, I respect the man. I've got a lot of experience from him. What he's saying is that he's working on multi-million pound deals. So why should he waste his capital, his time and his effort on choosing a deal with me that earns 125 grand each? And I probably forgot to take into account tax issues, interest payments, etc. So he has a valid point, but the way that he put me down wasn't the right thing to do, because I was showing initiative. I was, in a sense, making money presenting the opportunity to make money. Now, it didn't fit into his business model. That's fine. However, I wasn't going to end there. I could earn 250,000 quid. My dad's not interested. So I then took the deal to my uncle. And my uncle looked at it and said, "This is a damn good deal." And that's when I actually went in partnership with he's actually my cousin, but he's an older cousin. So I refer to him as uncle. Out of respect. And he was the first person to back me. And when my dad found out, he said, "Right, I want you to resign." He said, you cut off. He said, "Not from the will or anything like that. You've not done anything major." He said, "But you cut off, right? I'm not going to pay you any salaries anymore. Go and do what you want to do with Mitch." So that was my first venture out, letting go of the branch and being on my own. And what that led to was Mitch's and My Business now, which is 12 years later. We're the largest private supplier to emergency homeless in the city.
Wow. Were you scared though when you thought, or were you really hungry, right? This deal's going ahead.
Yes, but no. Accreditation. I wasn't scared because I had nothing to lose. I was using opium. And when I say opium, let me explain. That's OPM, other people's money. So yes, I have a responsibility. Yes, I was scared that I was going to let down my uncle, but it was asset-backed. So the idea, this is the beauty of property, it's asset-backed. What's the worst that can go wrong? We offered 75% of the property's value in a quick deal. So what's the worst that can happen? We don't get the planning that we wanted to. We put it back in the auction and we get our money back. That was the plan. But what actually happened was, that it was a bed and breakfast at the time. And it takes about 6 months to a year to get the right planning. So we said, "Well, let's carry on as a B&B." And it was at the credit boom. So what actually happened was, it was a 20-year-old business that was only being sold because of a breakup of marriage of the owners. So we just continued trading and we were taking £300 a day, £300 a night. So I thought, well, that's better than paying the holding costs and interest payments, et cetera, until we get planning. Then the credit crunch hit when we got the planning. But we actually noticed that next door was a hostel and we found out that they were charging a heck of a lot more than we were. So we thought, if we can't beat them, join them. We actually started taking intakes from all around the Midlands. We specialise in women fleeing domestic violence. I must say that we're not philanthropists, although it's a philanthropic branch. Yeah. Does good to the community. I am by no means some kind of savior or saint. We are a business, we make a profit, but we take pride and have ethos and good ethics in what we do. So we think we give a great service to the council and to the people that we look after. And we haven't closed for 12 years. Not one day, not one minute, we have not closed. And this again feeds in to another question that you're going to ask, I think, which is, how do you cope with the stress? You know, that's a normal question that comes out, but I think it's a perfect time to bring it up.
Yeah,
now.
Go on. Yeah.
Because the way I cope is because although I deal with tens of millions of pounds worth of deals, sometimes on a monthly basis, it's not the same as the hostel industry and the care industry, because that's people's lives. That's women, that's children, it's old people, young people, unaccompanied asylum seekers. And I've got a duty of care to these guys, and their lives are at stake 24 hours a day. When I started the hostel business and the homeless shelter business, I used to have my laptop open, watching all the cameras, making sure that everything's okay. And then I realized that actually, as long as I get the right people, they've got the right qualifications, right DBS checked, right training, I've got the right processes, procedures in place, then that's all I can do. So how that helped me in the property business is because if I can deal with the stress of people's lives, then dealing with the stress of money is far less important when it comes to the mental stress it puts on you. And running a 24-hour business for 12 years teaches you to switch off, which is a hard thing normally to do.
Yeah, because you get used to the norm, and when you're by yourself, you're thinking, well, this is what I'm supposed to be doing, I presume.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, now where you are now, and the numbers are incredible, and hats off to you, because I mean, when I was looking at Bregget Estates, I mean, you launched it properly in 2016, and where you are now, it's very plaudable. Now, what's your take on, are you going 100 miles an hour, or are you exiting? What's your take on it? Because there's a lot of people within business, but it's different when it's asset-based, like you said. What would be your kind of take on, right, well, this is what I want to do. Are you still hungry for more?
Yeah, well, it all started when my father passed away in 2016. That's when I took the helm. And as you say, Bradgate started off. And the plan was to finish my father's legacy. When he passed away, the usual rule of thumb is that someone passes away, you sell all their assets, you pay off the tax man, and then what's left is left to the beneficiaries. Now, we had two choices. One, that was the main choice that was going to happen. But my father had three huge deals on, namely the London Road site, the Sheffield Brooks Place deal, and the Nottingham deal. Now, to just liquidate them and sell them would have earned a fraction of the value, or would have realized a fraction of the value of if you completed the deal. So my job was to add value to the estate and maximize the value, and also protect my father's legacy. So it's a great question, because that legacy, and I look at it as a term in office, you know, I might be the CEO, but I'm just one of five shareholders that is my siblings and my children and my siblings' children's. So my mandate was to complete my father's legacy. Now, that mandate finishes this year. That's the legacy completed. So what do? I'm finding it very hard to, you know, and you can look at yourself, and this is where agendas come in. And my agenda has to be in the best interest of my shareholders. Otherwise, I shouldn't have the job. No CEO should have the job unless they are doing what they're doing in the best interest of the shareholders. And that's, I think, by law as well as by ethics. And I'm finding it hard to argue with myself that, you know, we've created a lot of wealth within the company. By the time we finish our pipeline projects, we're going to own circa 450 flats in Leicester, including retail, commercial, industrial. I'm finding it hard to actually say, well, why not just refinance them all on a repayment package over the next 15 years, polish the entities that we've got, and then in 15 years, we'll own 450 to 500 flats with no mortgages on them. How can that not be the best plan rather than take the golden goose into battle, so to speak, or, you know, into a five-year cycle of £2 million down to buy the land, another £1 million getting the planning and everything in place? Okay, you might earn a good profit on the back end, but as COVID's taught me, and inflation, interest rate rise, that I don't think I need to take the risk with my shareholders' money. That's my point. Now, how do we grow? I think we grow by working with other companies. Bradgate Estates has earned the right now to do £50 million deals, two, three at a time, potentially, because of our business model. Now, the reason why we can't do that is because, A, I don't want to risk the capital. B, we don't have the capital to just gamble on £100 million worth of pipeline projects. We would like cash in reserves, a nice cushion, and we want to make sure we're the best at what we do. And it's a very corny term, but it's true. Grow organically, you know, and not too fast. So going back to my favorite saying, opium, other people's money, I feel, and my board agree with me, that we are going to get Bradgate tied up in a nice bow and expand organically with our pipeline projects. But in order to do the big deals, we think we're better off actually partnering with estates departments, high net worth individuals, and companies that don't realize the value of their assets. Now, I'm going to say an example. I'm not going to name the actual company because I've not had any talks with them. But a pub chain, for instance, put 78 flats up, I think, with Savills during the lockdown. Now, that's all fair and good. I'm sure they did the right thing. But if they would have come to Bradgate Estates, we would have appraised each site. And what would have happened is they would have sold it to a developer. He would have appraised each site, got planning, flipped half of them, developed the other half, and made 10 million more. So what we're saying is partner with an East Midlands specialist. We're not too big not to care, and we're not too small to be able to get exactly what you need, the finance side of it, et cetera. And we want to work with these estates departments to realize the value of their assets, basically, and use their money to make them the profits that we were achieving. And we're happy to have the consultancy fees that go along with it.
And you're actually adding on profit to the business, whereas they are now looking to let it go pretty much and do the second phase, what somebody else would, but you want to bring that in-house to them and say, hey, here's a light bulb moment. This is what we've done. Fancy doing it, pretty much.
Exactly. And you know, board members are on high salaries because they achieve a lot of income and they have a lot of stress. Why should Bradgate pay our salaries? This way, we can diversify out. Big business can pay our salaries, but also we can make a lot of money for them. We can turn around the brownfield sites and bring them back into use. We can add towards the need for housing and the targets within the government. We can create jobs as well through doing it. So it's a win-win-win-win, which is always the best deal to have when everybody wins. So that's on the agenda.
My next question is, there's a lot of people, and it's kind of very trendy to be a property developer, entrepreneur, landlord at the minute. What would be your three tips on young property professionals or people trying to get into property and kind of finding the right network to get in the mix with? Because it's hard to just, you know, Google and finding network events, because that's not where it happened from my experiences. What's your couple of tips on that?
Well, I think the first tip is finance. You know, how are you going to fund it? Now, you can fund it, in my opinion, by finding a good deal. If you find the deal, the money will come. Now, it's complicated. So you can't just say, get your finances in order. Okay, I will. You know, what does that mean? What that means is you need a way to pay for the deal that you've seen a profit in. And the way I did it was I scoured the internet. I scoured the auction books, and I found a property that looked like a good deal. I had an end value once I got the planning, and then I had a cost to do it, and that left me with a reverse appraisal, it's called, for the land value, and there was £250,000 profit in it. So what I did was went to a financier. Normally you'd go to the bank. When you get to a point where you've got some of your own capital, you go to the bank. But someone starting off won't have the credibility to go to the bank. And if they don't have the savings or the finance, go to somebody with money with an actual deal presented in the right way and ask them to fund it for you. And in return, they get a charge over the property, they get interest on the money they lend you, and they get 50% of the profits. So that's my first tip. Get your finances in order of how you're going to fund it. And if you don't have your finances, then take the deal to someone who does and split it 50-50. Now, there may be, oh, well, they'll steal the deal off me. Well, no offense, there is no deal if you can't finance it. And what's the worst that can happen? They say they're not interested, but you can get commission for handing the deal over to them. So that's my first tip. Second tip is you need to find and you need to go into the network and the world of that industry. And what I mean by that is that if you're into property, then you need to be part of MIPIN, Team Leicester. You need to go to the auction houses because it's very clicky. It's one of those scenarios where, you know, and I'm lucky enough now to say I don't go to the auctions because the deals that are in the auctions are too small for what we do now. But I still go on a private capacity to keep my feet on the ground, you know, and I will be dabbling back into there when I start to slow down, go past my bell point. And when I start to retire in how many years that is, we all know you never really retire if you've got that spirit in you. I'll just go back to my roots with no stress, no hassle, and go one or two houses a year like I used to do. So go to the auction houses. Doesn't matter if you're bidding or not. See how it is. See the people that are there. Don't be afraid to go up to competitors or potential competitors, people in the industry. If they think you've got money or access to money, they'll be very amenable to you in terms of giving you information and help. And I think another thing as well that's thrown around that's actually quite true, fake it a bit until you make it, you know, if that makes sense. Don't go in there saying, I don't know anything about this. I know nothing. You know, people aren't going to ostracize you. You know, go in and say, look, I've got a financer. I've got a backer. I know a bit about the property market. I'm thinking of expanding. You know, people will then feed off your energy, feed off your credibility as well, and then build it up. So the second tip is go to the circles of which the sectors contain within and start finding out who's who. And the sort of people that can help you move forward.
It's very personality based as well. I mean, when I met you, the first thing I said to you, right, you've got so many stories. You're coming on my podcast, and I was happy to say it. And I think in this world, and it's in business as well, people buy off people. If you are going to fake it, then that guy probably knows. But he's thinking, right, let me give him that energy and let's see where it goes. So the personality thing, I think we should put it into the mix as well.
That's exact. I agree with you there. And you know, I don't work with people I don't like. You know, sometimes I have to, but in general, I do not work with people I don't like because I don't have to. And it's took me a long time to be able to do that. But now I can do that. It actually, work goes a lot more smoothly when you've got a cohesive team. Yeah. So I think personalities are definitely important. Some jobs don't need personalities. You know, I don't want my tax advisor to be a part-time comedian, you know, for instance. But I still like my tax advisor. He's funny, you know, in his own way. And I use him, A, because he's very good, but B, because we get on together, you know, as well. And I think if you've got a positive relationship, if you've got a good personality, you're always going to outshine the ones that don't. And it's all about getting to the top, having that edge. And anything that gives you that edge is going to take you to the top faster.
Brilliant. Did you have a final tip or share?
Yeah. So, yeah, my final tip is persistence. And you know, don't be afraid to be knocked down, to lose out on a deal. There's going to be more deals. Deals always look worse off when you walk away from them. You always kick yourself and think, but let me tell you something, there's nothing worse than doing a deal and overpaying, and that hammer goes down and you realize that you've gone 20 grand over your budget and you've done it out of pride. You know, there's no pride in losing money. There's no shame in walking away from a deal when you've set your limits from it. So my third point is don't be disjointed from being knocked down. It's part of the process. You have to get yourself up, dust yourself off, and keep on going. Persistent.
Brilliant. What's your advice on you've created a very good business lifestyle. If there was something to that you would like to change, what would you tell your 18-year-old self, what you know now?
Ooh, what would I like to change?
Well, more to the fact that there's someone here young that's listening to this. The unknown is the wall of fear, right? And there's certain things where entrepreneurs, property developers are aware of now that think, you know what, I wish I could tell someone, an 18-year-old, or if I knew this before, this would have changed my life.
I think I would tell them that it's okay to be scared. It's okay to not know what you want to do. All you need to know is that you want to be the top of whatever you pick eventually. I didn't start in business till I was 24. I was working small jobs in bars, traveling the world when I was 24. Then I said, right, this is serious. And that's when I started. So it's okay to be afraid. It's okay to not know what you want to do. And it's not about money. It's about success. If you have success and happiness, money is the third most important factor. And it's great. It gives you choices. But when it comes to my children, and I was under pressure, I was the oldest son in the family of a very successful man. And it's very hard to fill shoes like that. I'm not going to put the same pressure. I'm working so hard to break that link. I don't expect one of my children, or will be pushing them to take over the helm at Bradgate Estates. If it falls that way, then fair enough. But I just want them to be happy and successful in whatever path they choose, whether that's a geography teacher, a mathematician, a businessman, a lawyer, doctor, a butcher, baker, candlestick maker. It doesn't matter as long as they're happy and they're successful.
Brilliant. It's so great to hear from you about your journey, how what you've done, how you've got there, and the kind of realism instead of the corporate way of kind of giving the vision or the story that's happened. So I'm sure there's a lot of people that are going to be commenting on this podcast. Now, to round things up, I asked this question, and I'm sure you've heard it. Where do you see yourself in 5 years' time, personally and in business? We've touched on it, but this is my kind of closing.
I mean, it's like the stock market, this business is. It's very, very high pressured. So I always say, in 5 years' time, that's it. I'm going to be on a beach. I'm going to be building my dream house on the coast somewhere. But it never seems to come to fruition. Yeah. So where I see myself is Bradgate Estates in a nice bow, so to speak. Legacy finish, growing organically, as I said. Potentially working with big business on large industrial deals, £50 million plus. It's such a one way or the other. I'll either be retired but overlooking the company and seeing how it's going, or I'll be doing bigger and bigger deals. And it all depends what the future holds and where the chips fall.
Where do you want it to be right now?
I want to be happy and successful, which leads me back to the other side. If happy and successful is building my dream holiday home with my family around me on a 2-year sabbatical, great. If my wife decides that she doesn't want to go abroad and she wants to stay in Leicester, then I will focus more on the big business side. But most likely, I'll be exactly where I am now, doing bigger deals, working with great caliber people, and pushing the boundaries of construction, in the East Midlands.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for being a guest on the Social Connection podcast. I hope people are getting so much knowledge from this episode. If people wanted to get in touch with you, what are your either social media channels or website and email that they can get in touch with you?
I think the best thing to do is go on the internet, see our website, and then there's a way to connect through there. Send an email to us and I'll answer every single email that comes in. I do get quite a few, so bear with me if it takes a couple of days to get back unless it's an urgent email. but I'm happy to chat to anybody. I've got time for every single person that gives me a call, and I'm happy to give advice, especially to people that are starting up their own business or adding value to the community and the East Midlands region.
Brilliant. So if that's Google Bradgate Estates and you'll be diverted.
Bradgate Estates, go onto the website and then there's a how to contact us on it.
Brilliant. If any of you listeners
Or Facebook me personally, my Facebook message.
Okay, brilliant. If you have found this episode worthy of a share or like, please do share this on your Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, TikTok, and we will make sure we share it too. I am Atish Palmer on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And please do tag our company business, which is Metric Connect. And once again, thank you, Joe. This has been a very, very good episode, and I can't wait till everyone hears it. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. I've enjoyed it. Thank you, Atish. We'll